Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Hello and welcome to the Whale Hunting Podcast, where we shine a light onto hidden worlds of money and power. I'm Tom Wright, and this week I'm joined by Bradley Hope to bring you a special live episode of the podcast from Brazen's new studios here in London.
And with Tom here in London for the, you know, one of his rare trips into town, we thought we'd take some time to fill you in on some of the updates from the 1MDB story, obviously one of our favorites. And there's all kinds of interesting things to discuss this week.
Yeah, so what's been going on, I'm sure people out there who are interested in 1MDB, obviously the largest financial scandal ever, you know, $6 to $7 billion stolen, used to make films like The Wolf of Wall Street, Jolo still on the run in China, but lots of things to catch up on. One of the key things here is Najib Razak, the former prime minister of Malaysia, who was instrumental to this whole scheme because Jolo couldn't have stolen the billions without him being prime minister and giving him, you know, the run of this fund, 1MDB, from which the money was stolen. Najib obviously was found guilty, given 12 years in jail. Recently, back in earlier this year, the king of Malaysia halved his sentence, caused huge consternation in Malaysia because people said, well, why is this guy who's helped to steal billions of our hard-earned tax dollars being let off so easily? But there's quite a few interesting things going on here. One is that Najib is likely to get out before Malaysia's next general election. He could be out as early as 2026. 2028 at the latest under this pardon. But he's also got another trial going on because he was found guilty on a very small sliver of money at the beginning. And there's a trial going on for a much larger fraud. And there's been some very interesting developments in that, hasn't there, Bradley? So one thing that's happened is one of Jolo's inner circle who'd been on the run with him in China, this woman called Jasmine Liu, who was, you know, involved with all of this, one of his right-hand women, as it were, she, for some reason, left his exile in China and came back to Malaysia. We don't quite know why. And she's now one of the star witnesses in Najib Razak's other trial for corruption. So tell us a little bit about Jasmine Liu and what's been going on with her.
So Jasmine was a lawyer that worked at 1MDB, but she was very close to Joe. And what we learned from the DOJ filings was that she also received a lot of money from some offshore companies that were related to the fraud. So she also had a pretty fancy house in New York City. So clearly considered by the DOJ and others to be a conspirator, not just sort of a passive witness. When Jolo went on the run, a lot of other people went on the run as well, including Jasmine. And what she's been saying so far in some of the public comments that have come out is that she actually was not exactly with Jolo during this time on the run. She was in Thailand, among other places, but sort of living on her own. And it's quite fascinating because she described how Jolo was menacing and threatening towards her, sort of telling her, don't you dare go back to Malaysia. Your life will be, I'll make your life miserable. So kind of feeling in danger. And at the same time, giving her almost a ridiculously small amount of money to keep her going, like thousands of dollars a year. So it's interesting, you know, I know that when we were tracking Jolo very closely, we definitely heard that there was these kind of divisions that had formed. So Jasmine was in one place, Joe and his team were in another place. For a period of time, Joe told everyone Jasmine's not to be trusted. She's kind of like, you know, gone off the reservation, so to speak. And then she kind of came back into the fold, and then she mysteriously shows up in Malaysia, and it's unclear why. I think one of the things my mind thinks it goes to is that she really wants to just get back to a normal life, just kind of face the charges rather than live on the run with these small outlays from Jolo or whatever. You know, she doesn't have a serious income. And so she's definitely the most interesting person to show up in Malaysia since the Najib trial began.
I mean, she was right at the center of the fraud. She was in charge of 1MDB's relationship with Goldman Sachs as well, we shouldn't forget. Goldman Sachs obviously helped raise a lot of money for 1MDB. A partner at Goldman Sachs, Tim Leissner, is now awaiting his sentencing. He's pleaded guilty to helping steal, you know, $200 million. There was rumors that Jasmine Liu had an affair with Tim Leissner, which we never were able to like prove that, but that was definitely in the ether. So she's, yeah, as you say, she's really one of the people who was at the heart of the scam. And now people are sort of wondering what else she's going to say while she's and whether she's going to get a deal herself. Because, you know, Najib's already in jail. So she's like, I'm not sure how much she can offer prosecutors in Malaysia and whether she herself will stay out of jail. And as you said, it's tempting to see Joe Lo as a cuddly figure in a way, like a guy who stole billions, but isn't that dangerous? That's often how he's portrayed. But what, as you've just painted, Jasmine's, what she's been saying since she's came back to Malaysia is interesting, that he threatened her. And we haven't really heard a lot about Joe Lo on that level, have we? But you know, you don't do these kinds of schemes without making big enemies and without being in life-threatening situations. So maybe there's a harder edge to cuddly Joe Lo, right?
I think so. Probably over time, he got a harder edge too, because even last night we were hearing a story about how in his house here in London on Stratton Street, he spent a huge amount of money making a snuggle room. And in this room was very comfortable and full of lots of soft areas to lay down and watch movies. And they had a vibrating floor so that when you're watching Top Gun, the room like vibrates. But so, you know, he loved Kung Fu Panda. There was a kind of childish side to Joe Lo. But I think as time went on, as he became sort of, he went from Joe Lo the kind of huckster to Joe Lo the hardened criminal, you know, because you kind of inevitably have to become that in order to go on the run and be a spy in China and work with all these kind of pretty dark characters.
You know? So you said, you know, she probably came back to Malaysia. We're guessing because maybe there was a sick relative. She wanted to see family. It's not easy to be on the run in China and basically under some kind of house arrest likely. And she was in Thailand. There are a lot of other folks who really helped carry out this scheme who are also supposedly with Joe Lo in Shanghai or wherever he is now. We've lost track of him. Since last year when we were running our YouTube campaign to try to find him, we located him at Shanghai Disneyland and in an office tower in Shanghai, the World Financial Center, I think it's called, the one with the hole on the Bund or on the Pudong side. So he was living there, and then you've got like people like Fat Eric, as he's known, one of his right hand men, Seet Lin Lin, the smart Singaporean who was part of the inner circle. Those guys are all, we as far as we know, still living and with Joe Lo, right?
Yeah, he has been traveling for years with this kind of movable feast. There's people like Fat Eric, who was a karaoke bar manager who became almost like a straw man for Joe. Like he would use him to sign. Joe Lo would write emails on his behalf and pretend to be him. You know, remember some of the paintings were bought by this karaoke guy.
A useful idiot for Joe.
Yeah, and these guys all have families now. So they're married, they have children. So it's kind of this strange sitcom of relatively soft money laundering financial criminals on the run, staying in fancy places, eating a lot. So I think we heard that there's, you know, sometimes up to five meals a day because they're just bored, you know. But in more recent times, my guess is, based on some of the stuff we've been hearing, is that Joe Lo's world got even smaller and smaller and smaller. So there was a time when he was going to Thailand. There was this Thai guy, Phing Phien Lao Gum Nerd, who was helping, you know, rent hotel rooms and stuff for him. He was traveling around. But then as the circle sort of narrowed, it seems like right now Joe Lo is really in a dark place.
Well, this is because a lot of Joe Lo's protectors in China, well, we should quickly explain to people why he's in China. After all of this came out, you know, we reported at the Wall Street Journal and others reported on it. He was told by Najib, when Najib was still prime minister, go to China, stay out of the way. He has relatives in China. He's a Chuchao Chinese. And so he went there and then he got involved in a lot of corrupt deals involving Chinese officials to make even more money. This is like post 1MDB. All of those officials, as far as we know, the main ones that were involved in the schemes with him, which were, you know, infrastructure, corrupt infrastructure deals, have been arrested by President Xi Jinping. That includes a former trade and industry minister and a guy called Sun Lijun, who was a very senior security official. So as those guys have been arrested for corruption, and Xi Jinping's government has sort of got a handle on it, Zhou's lost his protection, hasn't he? And that sort of brings us to Pras Michel of the Fugees, which is my way to segue to this very strange eddy of a story that's also related to 1MDB. Pras Michel of the Fugees was connected to Zhou and Zhou's attempts to try to get the US government to drop its charges into him through some of those corrupt Chinese officials, wasn't he? So let's explain what's going on with Pras Michel's trial connected to Zhou.
Yeah. I mean, on a high level, Zhou stole money. He went on the run. He found safe haven in China where they considered him an asset because he could remote control Malaysia because of Najib's need to stay in power and to make this 1MDB scandal go away. China did deals that allowed Malaysia to plug some of the holes. There's these gaping holes where the 1MDB money is missing. And then, unfortunately, Najib was voted out of office, which is a rare thing to happen for a kleptocrat. Usually they find some way to stay in office through another version of corruption. And he got voted out of office, and then suddenly everything was exposed. So Zhou went from China's greatest asset, controlling this important country in Asia, to a liability. So still, on the run, Zhou's obsession was, how do I buy my way out of this problem? So he had access to billions of dollars still, or at least hundreds of millions. And he thought, how can I spend this? We even heard from people that visited him on his yacht. He said, everyone's got a price, even the DOJ. And that was his idea in his head. So he set in motion these different ways to access people around the Trump administration, thinking that whatever they need, we can give them. So it could be a settlement, a cash settlement. You know, then everybody walks away happy. You know, Zhou's off of the case; they get $500 million or whatever. To, you know, he thought that would be the price. And the variety of techniques he used, one of them was this guy Pras Michel, who was an obviously a member of the Fugees, but kind of the least known of the three. And it, from our reporting, broke as hell back in that time. And Zhou sort of changed his life with life-transforming money. And initially, Zhou wanted a picture with Obama. So Pras took more than $20 million, gave it to friends who donated it to Obama, and eventually got Zhou that picture. You know, got him into the room for a campaign.
We should say Pras Michel had been a supporter of the Democrats and had been around sort of bundlers around the Democrats. And that's why he was used. Zhou had met him at those famous parties that he would throw with celebrities. Pras, by that time, a C-list celebrity, but he would turn up at, you know, Joe's famous birthday party on the Las Vegas Strip, or Joe's 30th or 31st birthday, whatever that was. And that was, you know, just somebody he knew who then said, hey, I can help you, you know, sort of get you close to Frank White and some of these other bundlers who were sending money to the Democrats, got him that photograph. But then Zhou decides to, that the one way that he's trying to sort of get himself out of the legal jeopardy in the U.S. by bribing, trying to get people to drop the case, which is kind of pretty naive, given that it was pretty far along with the DOJ by that point. But then he also has to do the bidding of the Chinese government because he's in China and those people want certain things, don't they? And one of the things they wanted was to get this Chinese billionaire called Guo Wengui sent back to China, who was a billionaire on the run in exile in the US. So Zhou tries to also get involved in that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically he's trying to handle all of his masters. So he's got his master in Malaysia, somebody he has to try to make things better. He's trying to fix that problem. His masters in China, they have this agenda. They want to get this guy. He has all this money. So what does he do? He hires Pras, who gets money to the Obama campaign and other things. And then eventually Pras finds this woman, Nikki Lum Davis, another fascinating character. She's from Hawaii. Her parents famously arrested and imprisoned for illegally funneling Chinese money into American politics. It turns out it runs in the family business. She did the same style of thing and was eventually arrested for it. And she, in turn, found Elliot Broidy, who was a major campaign financier for the Trump campaign. So all of this money went to these people, and they all tried in various ways to do this favor of getting to Trump and saying, hey, can you drop this case? For geostrategic reasons, you know, this is our ally in Asia. You need to drop this case and relieve the pressure, because otherwise Islamic extremists will take over, and making those kinds of arguments. Even at one point related to this, there was the casino tycoon, Steve Wynn, showed up and actually handed Donald Trump a letter about Guo Wengui. And it was all part of this kind of exchange, you know, giving this to China, giving this to Malaysia, getting this for Joe.
Very, very complicated story. But the long and the short of it is that Pras Michel last year was found guilty of illegally funneling donations into both the Obama administration and the Trump administration, given a jail sentence. And so what's going on with that? He's appealed that, right?
Well, yes, he appealed it with some interest. There was an interesting twist, which was one of his lawyers was allegedly an investor in a legal AI company, and he used allegedly this AI to write the closing arguments of the case. Of course, Pras lost the case. Pras found out about it. Now he's trying to appeal on the grounds that his lawyer improperly used AI to defend him. So it's also kind of an interesting.
So he wants a retrial, but just this week the judge ruled that his application to have the trial thrown out is unfounded, and so he's still got one get out of jail card, which is if the judge rules that the AI is justifiable, and then he would have a new trial, right? But pretty amazing. And you know, the Fugees, you've got Lauryn Hill went to jail for tax problems. Pras, Wyclef Jean's still cool. Nothing happened to him.
Yeah. So. They did have a chance to reunite for a concert, I think, last summer, though I heard it didn't go so well.
Well, we had a great event here last night in London with Friends of Brazen, and to launch our new studio here. And we were talking to somebody who was involved in the prosecutions in America, and I was congratulating him, to saying that you know, U.S. justice is not perfect, but at least the DOJ, the Department of Justice, does prosecute white collar crimes, and it tries to do it on a global basis. You know, you could argue that here in England and in other places, they've been a lot slower to prosecute this 1MDB case, which of course happened, you know, over a decade ago now. And let's talk about Switzerland, right? A lot of this money flowed through Switzerland. No surprise there. Great offshore banking center. Banking secrecy is paramount there. You go to jail for breaking banking secrecy in Switzerland. And two of the key players in this whole fraud, Tarek Obaid and Patrick Mahoney, are Swiss citizens. Their company was based there. Very quickly, to explain what they did, when the first billion was stolen in 2009, it was routed through their company, Petro Saudi, which was set up in Switzerland. They helped steal that first billion. And they are now on trial. The wheels of justice work very slowly in Switzerland, but they're now on trial. Tell us what's going on with Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obaid.
Well, it was actually interesting. Back when this case first broke, I remember that the Swiss made a public announcement completely out of character. They said, this is a huge deal. They even called it a theft. I think they called it something quite extreme. And they said, we are prosecuting this case. And then nobody heard anything from Switzerland for a long time. So finally, something's happening. The Switzerland's reputation as a place that can actually prosecute white-collar crime is on the line. And these two individuals were connected to a critical first fraud of 1MDB. And it's interesting because, so obviously, a lot of, if everyone can remember, there was this whole idea that this money wasn't stolen, it was a donation from Saudi Arabia, right? And that is all related to this guy, Tarek, who was a kind of bagman for Prince Turki bin Abdullah, who was the son of King Abdullah at the time. Not a particularly well-known prince, and he had a company called Petro Saudi, which had no assets. It just had the fact that it was owned by the son of the King of Saudi Arabia. And it had the name Petro Saudi, gave it this sort of official sense to it. So anyways, this guy, Tarek especially, is really a fundamental figure in the fraud. And probably, I would say, next to Jolo, the one that got away with the most money. Because what happened was this kind of fake company joint venture that they created, the money that went into that was squirreled away by Petro Saudi. But then they used the money to do another corrupt deal in Venezuela, where essentially they bought some drill ships. And then as far as I can see from the documents, bribed officials there to rent the drill ships and then use it had that going for several years. Then the Venezuelan government stopped paying. They sued the Venezuelan government and they won. And they won quite a large amount of money. I think it was well over $100 million. So anyways, this was money that is kind of potentially, it's obviously derived from corruption, but it's within the realm of Tariq Obaid. Tariq Obaid also famously bought gold, jewels, a blue diamond worth millions of dollars. None of these things have been recovered. So he's definitely one of the people that has the most money, and he deserves to be scrutinized very closely.
So they're on trial in Bellinzona, in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. They've pleaded not guilty to this. In the dock, Mahoney struggled to remember the details of this first loan. It was this first billion that was stolen from 1MDB was set up to be a loan to Petro Saudi from 1MDB, the Malaysian front from which Jolo stole all the money. The thing that I've had a really hard time understanding is why it's taken so long to get to trial. I mean, don't forget, these guys were arrested years ago now. And, you know, the only place in the world apart from Malaysia where Najib has gone to jail, where anyone else has gone to jail, is Singapore, where I live, which put some private bankers working for a bank called BSI in jail. They're all out already. So meanwhile, you know, Switzerland hasn't even really... it definitely hasn't put anyone in jail, right? Do we know why that's the case?
Well, I mean, if I'm going to be generous, I would say that very few governments in the world are actually equipped to handle a case like this, because the complexity, the international nature of it, it's very hard to pursue. It's very expensive to pursue. The Department of Justice in the U.S. has developed a sort of a process for going through these cases, and they have the budget to do it, you know, and they have the kind of the willpower. So I think they are very complicated. Even the legal system in America is sort of optimized to handle these cases, whereas in Switzerland, this is very novel, you know, all of these cross-border transactions and things like that. You know, I think this happens a lot with white-collar crime. The people who've gone to jail so far, until Najib, were just the low-level guys that made mistakes and maybe did it willfully. The big ones, Joe Lowe, Tim Leissner, somehow have avoided going to jail. Now we'll see with Tariq and Patrick.
So let's talk about Tim Leissner. So obviously Tim Leissner was a partner at Goldman Sachs, arrested, pleaded guilty to helping steal $200 million, dated Kamora Lee Simmons, the reality TV star. So why hasn't he been sentenced? One, again, at a party we had last night with a lot of people who had been following this very closely, there was a lot of gossip about that. Like, he's been helping the government, the U.S. government, in its investigations. Another Goldman managing director, a more junior person who was actually Tim's employee at Goldman, was found guilty, and he's been sent back to Malaysia. He's a Malaysian, and the Malaysians are going to deal with him now. So once that guy was sent back to Malaysia, we all thought, oh well, now Tim's going to be sentenced because, you know, he's no more useful. He's no longer useful in any further investigations. It's not as if it's going to go up the food chain to former CEO Lloyd Blankfein or anyone like that. But what I heard last night was, and this is fascinating, is that as part of the deal with him, the Department of Justice was seized his shares in a drinks company that Tim Leissner set up with Kamora Lee Simmons called Celsius. I think that's right. It's like an energy drink company. And that company blew up and became extremely successful. All kinds of fraudulent claims, like it helped you lose weight. It's basically water, it's like or some kind of energy drink. And so the shares have kept increasing in value. And so now the Department of Justice, the money that they've seized from him is increasing exponentially. And it's causing all kinds of confusion about like how much Tim should be allowed to keep and how much should be given over. So I think that's potentially one explanation for why he hasn't been sentenced, because again, this is a long time after the fact, right? And this guy's still not seen the inside of a jail cell.
I mean, it would be really amazing if he gets sort of no prison time and gets to keep some of those shares. I mean, that would be incredible. The guy clearly doesn't seem to care much about what he's been through. He's been cited in fancy restaurants in New York City, Los Angeles, you know, wearing all black.
We reported in Whale Hunting last year that he was seen dining in a Michelin restaurant off Rodeo Drive in LA on the sidelines of the Milken conference. I mean, so if you know, for listeners who are interested in how the world really works and how power really works, I think this is a fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah. The cynical lesson is make sure that your crime is huge and complicated and entangle lots of people and then turn on all of them at the end and you'll be fine. You know, that's sort of the lesson here.
What is that? What is it? What is the epigraph in our book from Bob Dylan? Steal a little and they put you in jail. Steal a lot and they make you king.
Yeah, exactly.
So do we have any questions?
Yeah, well, there's one question here about, will Joe be arrested soon? I think it goes to the heart of this, his situation in China. Obviously, we reported that there have been talks between China and Malaysia about turning him over. I think the kind of consensus among everyone who's watching this case is there's a sense of let's leave the status quo. Joe goes back to Malaysia and starts talking. It causes huge problems for China. He knows the ins and outs of potentially other corrupt deals in China, how China works, how the intelligence apparatus works. And then also he knows about other people in Malaysia that may have received money at some point or another. One thing we know about Joe Lo in this fraud is that he was extremely generous with other people's money. He was paying people left and right, and for good reason, because it does protect him in these situations. The U.S. government has no chance of getting him extradited to the United States from China, especially with what he knows about intelligence.
Well, there's no extradition treaty.
There's no extradition treaty, but also there's just no way, you know. And the U.S. hasn't even contemplated this idea of handing over Guo Wengui. So I think, you know, it seems like he's just sort of holed up in a kind of a house arrest situation. We haven't heard from his lawyers, touch wood, recently. I've heard that he doesn't even have those lawyers anymore, the people that we used to have to tangle with back in the good old days. So I think he's really just disappeared. You know, he's a family man now. We've reported that he has children. He's married to his high school sweetheart. His parents have been also seen in Hong Kong still. So potentially he has a kind of blissful domestic life somewhere in China, possibly outside Shanghai. It doesn't seem likely at this point he's going to be arrested. One thing that he should be aware of, which I'm sure he's aware of, is that the U.S. government, when they're looking for someone, they never stop. So 30 years from now, you step into the wrong airport and you can get arrested, you know? So he's going to have that hanging over him for the rest of his life.
If China ever lets him out. Another question we have here is, how do we know where he is? So, you know, obviously last year, Bradley and I ran the Where is Joe Lo campaign on YouTube. We got sent photos. So we know there was a not too recent now, but maybe a couple of years old photo of him at Shanghai Disneyland. He was also in Bangkok. But also, interestingly, a guy called Ki Kok Tiam, 56-year-old, he was involved with Joe Lo and knew about the whereabouts, right? Was that guy in with him in China? Is that right?
Yeah. So Ki was in Macau, I believe. He had a visa.
Where Joe Lo spent a lot of time as well.
Yeah. And interestingly, Ki, suddenly, the reason he left...
Well, explain who Ki is.
Yeah. So Ki was just one of these kind of somewhat important right-hand people of Joe Lo, involved in lots of different deals, had a business background and got kind of drawn into this whole thing. He had a visa to be in Macau. So he was part of the... There was a period of time where Joe was really operating in Macau. He was based there. He was transporting physical cash from Macau in helicopters and in boats to Hong Kong, depositing it in companies and then using that to pay lawyers and things like that. He really got good at money laundering by that point. But Ki was in that kind of circle. And then it's a bit mysterious, but his visa was canceled. So he couldn't stay in Macau anymore. He got on a plane. He ended up in Malaysia. He was immediately arrested, interrogated. He gave testimony. There was documents. And then suddenly he died. And so obviously everyone's mind's going to what happened here. Is there something more sinister? The family have been telling people, no, this was a kind of a tragic thing. I mean, maybe the stress got to him, but it wasn't actually like something more nefarious. As you know, in 1MDB, there's not a lot of physical violence. There was the lawyer that was killed who was connected to the...
Arrest warrant for Najib. Yeah, well, he had signed had been involved in drawing up the draft arrest warrant for Najib. And it was always unclear whether that prosecutor had been killed in connection to that or in connection to this other corruption scandal that involved a Malaysian doctor. He was found in a oil drum with cement in it.
At the bottom of a river.
At the bottom of a river in Malaysia. So that was the only death that was connected to 1MDB and never proven that it was directly related to his role there. But then you've got this guy, Ki Kok Tiam, who died. And again, the family is saying that was natural causes. he's the only, apart from Jasmine Liu, who we started this episode talking about, he was the only other person who's sort of come back to Malaysia from Jolo's Inner Circle. So
we have another question here about what's the latest with The Billion Dollar Whale as a film adaptation. Do you want to take that one, Tom?
Yeah, so that's fascinating. So we've been working on an adaptation. It's at the scripted stage at the moment. So the way these things work is you develop a script before you take it out and sell it to streamers or studios. And yeah, we're developing a killer script. It's going to be an amazing adaptation. It's kind of story where you've got to craft a point of view. There's so many different ways to tell it, right? Because you've got Jolo, you've got foreign characters, you've got Hollywood characters. So yeah, it's taken a while to crack how to tell it, but it's going really well, and that's going to be an amazing story when it comes out.
With our partners at SK Global, who made Crazy Rich Asians. Yep. That reminds me, there's another person known to jail, who's currently in jail, Hamad Al-Wazan, the Kuwaiti friend of Jolo from his university days. He's actually in jail in Kuwait. And I believe so is the Sheikh, the member of the royal family that he was involved with, because there was a period of time late in the scandal where Jolo really pivoted to Kuwait and was using this minor prince to launder some money through Kuwait. And those guys have been sentenced to prison.
For Chinese banks in Kuwait, of all things. So, well, I think that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. This was episode 20 of Whale Hunting and the last episode of season one. But we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with a brand new season. We'll be chatting with a bunch of interesting people about everything from President Xi of China to corporate lobbying in Washington. Furry subculture, Bradley. We've got a great show coming up on furries, if you know what they are.
On May 6th.
Yeah, furries are adults who wear anthropomorphic or animal suits. And we have a great podcast coming up on that, which people are going to love. Female narco bosses and much more. The best way to stay up to date with Whale Hunting is to hit follow wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also subscribe to the Whale Hunting newsletter for updates on the shadowy lives of the powerful and ultra wealthy at whalehunting.projectbrazen.com.
And we'd love to hear from you. Please get in touch. hello@projectbrazen.com. You can send us ideas. We'd love to respond to what people want to hear about.
Whale Hunting is a production of Project Brazen. It's hosted by me, Tom Wright, and Bradley Hope. It's produced by Megan Dean and Claire Urban. At Project Brazen, Mariangel Gonzalez is our project manager and Megan Dean is network manager. Ryan Ho is the creative director with additional design from Andrea Klarich. For more from Whale Hunting and to subscribe to our newsletter, visit whalehunting.projectbrazen.com.